There is no turning back the clock. Regimes can't hope to just reimpose what they had before and think that's going to work. It might work for a little while, but that just covers up the trouble. Now people don't want to be quiet. They don't have much to lose. And I think it's going to go on for a while. Another generation, perhaps.
That's how Jeremy Bowen ended his monumental 25-part series, Our Man in the Middle East. It ran on Radio 4 at 1:45 on weekdays, but it's clear that lots of people binge-listened to the programmes as 15-minute podcasts. I think it's the best radio or audio I've heard this year, certainly the best feature-making. Beautiful writing, of course, thought-provoking insights from a reporter who spent 25 years covering some of the world's bloodiest conflicts, but mixed with impeccably chosen archive and evocative music into storytelling of the highest order.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Hello, I'm Trevor Dan, and I've been to see Mark Savage this week. He was the lead producer on Our Man in the Middle East, and he's been giving me some fascinating insights into how the series was made.
Our Man in the Middle East. Jeremy Bowen reflects on a quarter of a century covering one of the world's most troubled regions. Part 16, A Taste of Fire and Smoke.
The people of Beirut and their friends mourn an age they think of now as lost and golden. Before 1975, when they lurched into 15 years of civil war that turned their tolerant city and all its glory to ash. In old black and white photographs, they display the way they were, steam engines in snowy, sunny mountains, Mercedes taxis in Martyrs Square, and beautiful women in jewels and gowns and long gloves, Lebanese Hepburns and Lorenz, arriving for some glittering evening. It is all generously anointed with the rose water of memory. The war years killed the old Beirut. In this song by the great Lebanese diva Fairuz, it was the time when Beirut tasted of fire and smoke and the city turned out its lamp. In the darkness, Lebanon's diverse communities, Shia, Sunni, Druze and Christian, turned on each other, helped as usual by the interference of outsiders.
What's it's away from us. Okay, so we move.
Since then, I've been caught up in some of the moments when it looked as if Lebanon sects wanted to go back to their worst times.
The firing we've just heard, I've been told by our security advisor, that was coming over our head, that one.
Mark, let's start with a simple question of definition. When you were planning this series, did you think of it as a series of radio shows or a series of podcasts? In fact, is there any difference in your mind?
It's a hard one to answer because I knew it was a radio series, but it became very clear to me somehow instinctively. I thought, these are podcasts that I'm making. And I also thought about making each one different. For example, in a radio series in the past, you might have used the same sort of theme tune in an introduction or so on. In a podcast, if you're binge listening, you don't want to hear that introduction again and again and again. You want to just cut to the chase with it. So that influenced me a bit. And then as the sort of responses came in, I became very much more aware that it seemed to me it felt more of a podcast than a radio series. But hey, actually, I'm not too wound up about the difference, really.
Tell me about the very beginning of it. How did you first hear it was to happen? Because it wasn't actually your idea, I believe.
No, it wasn't. I'd done a series, a 50-part series on India, there's half of them.
Is it Incarnations?
Yeah, that's right. And Mohit, the commissioning editor at Radio 4, came up to me and said, look, I want you to work with Jeremy Bowen because, you know the kind of way Radio 4 does history. I wasn't entirely sure. I did know the way Radio 4 did history. I kind of knew how I did history and that so on. And Incarnations had been a good training ground for me in any way about looking at that kind of, over that, a long period of time. So I sat down with Jeremy Bowen and his field producer, Cara, and I got him to, we really talked about the structure. So I think he needed help in actually shaping the thing, because it's pretty daunting to do any kind of series on the Middle East, let alone a sort of 25-part series. But for me, the main thing about it always was I was thinking in terms of from our own correspondent and storytelling. So I sat Jeremy down for 6 hours, two sessions of 3 hours each, and we would start. So this programme, what is it about? What is it? It's about the first Gulf War. Tell me a story about that. I wanted it to be personal. What do you remember that? What's the sort of key moment for you personally? So it would start with one of his stories and then widen out to the big geopolitical stuff. But I felt that in doing that, you're kind of taking the listener with you, and you're getting to see the Middle East through Jeremy Bowen's eyes. It felt very much after a while as though I am Jeremy Bowen.
Now, I completely agree with you as a listener, because he loves to talk about, being by the seaside, or what food he's eating, or what car he's travelling in. It's those little details that you would use if you were a storyteller, but you might not use if you were a reporter in the field doing a voice piece for the 6 o'clock news. And you've been a radio journalist for years. What was it like adapting to that?
I'd already adapted to that. I used to be a local radio journalist in news in Victor Radio, Radio Kent. And then I joined the features department. So my approach to documentaries was very much that sort of crafting and storytelling side of things. And I had the journalism knocked out of me a bit, that kind of put the most important fact at the top. And I noticed also with Jeremy, he was still quite often tempted to put what was the most important thing at the top and forget the story and come to the story after about a minute. And for me, that was a mistake. I would always say, no, you've got to start with the story, and we'll come to that later. You can just lure people in and then cosh them over the head with the big story, the geopolitics.
When the Israeli shell hit, I was about 100 yards away down the hill. I spun round and for a split second couldn't work out where the flames were coming from.
Oh, my God, it's happening.
Then I saw Abed's car was on fire.
That's Abed!
Oh, shit.
Dead.
He must be dead.
The shell had hit the back of the car while Abed was sitting in the driver's seat phoning his son.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
In the flames and the smoke, Abed was forcing himself out of the driver's window. His clothes were burning. He fell down onto the road where I couldn't see him. I said to Malik, let's get up there to help him. Malik's face was contorted. No, he said, don't do it. Abed is dead. He can't have survived that. And if you go up there too, they'll kill you. When, cautiously, I moved towards Abed's body, I heard bullets fizzing over my head and ducked back into cover. A team from The Times later said they heard the tank crew saying on the radio that they get the other two with a heavy machine gun. I'll feel guilty until my last day that we stopped to film there.
What do you think about the balance, though, between the, if I may say so, traditional BBC, put the facts first kind of journalism, and this, which is more discursive, more, as we said, personal, and, dare I say, more opinionated?
Well, it always was billed as his take on the Middle East, Jeremy Bowen's take on the Middle East. So I felt no problem with that. I think it's a question of you put your faith in Jeremy Bowen. He's been there, he's seen things. I'd expect him to give his opinion. And it certainly gives him a bit more free rein, perhaps, in the way he deals with things. But at the same time, he has to bring that journalistic integrity to something. So he needs to use the facts to back up what he's saying.
I mean, I was thinking of, for instance, some of the things he says about Tony Blair, about George Bush. Indeed, the very end of the series, that little speech at the end, that straightforward opinionising.
He's a person. He has a view. I'm interested to hear it. You may not agree with it, but at the same time, I think he should be free to be able to say what he thinks. And I think we make it clear that's his view. It's not as if we're saying you have to accept this. It's his opinion. Someone who's been there for 25 odd years, that's what he saw. That's the conclusion. That's the way he thinks about things.
So tell me about the process that you went through to actually physically make the programmes. Did you do the script first or did you collect the archive first? How did all that work?
Well, we sat down and we worked out what each programme would be. And we, as we went along, we just identified what the opening story would be of about two and a half, 3 minutes. I don't know, however long. And then it was sort of handing that over to Jeremy to do a first draft. So he'd come up with a script. And then, you know, I would think, I would come back, I would say, look, you need to do this here or do that there, or I don't think this works, or what about this, or can you explain more about that? But what I was also doing was looking at archive I could use so that it wasn't going to be just a monologue. And I also wanted to make the whole programme full of sound, really, and texture, so that it wasn't just, I don't think Jeremy drones on anyway, but I didn't want just the voice. This was partly a product of doing Incarnations, where we'd used an awful lot of sound and actuality to give it a real featurey feel, to kind of take you there. So I would be looking for sound and saying, what have I got to cover this section of the story? Actually, when he was telling a story, it was quite often easy enough to find the sort of sound you'd want to sort of very gently put in the background to try and create atmosphere, sound of an area or something that was happening or maybe music. And then you'd look for bits of archive that would give listeners a chance to sort of stop or take the action on or lift up the pace. And I thought if there was anything longer than 2 or 3 minutes of just Jeremy, then we needed to do something about that. So we kind of worked that in, and it was involved in this sort of to and fro between us, I think.
One of the things I really liked was the way you allowed his current contemporaneous comments to bleed into archive recordings of him in the field without finding it necessary to say, and here's a thing I said in September 19, whenever. It took the listener on a journey without too much hand-holding.
Yeah, there were times I worried about that because I thought, do we need to distinguish more between the here and now and the then? And I tried to do it without being too heavy-handed, so sometimes we would fade into a bit of archive to get the sense of joining. And I hoped that pretty much people could understand where they were, but I guess there were times when people weren't quite sure if that was then or this was now. And I don't know if it entirely mattered, really.
And what about the music, Mark? Where did you find that?
I mean, I'm used to using music a lot, and I know it really irks people who are getting on a bit, who find it hard to listen to the words and the music. But I also think it's a great thing, and it helps mood. So I would actually just quite often go on a music website, sit at the computer, run the bit that I wanted music with, and just play with the music. And did it have the right feel? I'd never go out and say, Here's a section about love. Let's Google love and music. You know, it just doesn't work like that.
That's daytime television.
Yeah. But other times I would say to Jeremy, look, what was the theme tune to this? What were people playing at the time? And, I mean, the first Gulf War, the Requiem for that was, you know, that was just an absolute gift. And I wasn't all that familiar with it, but once I'd heard it, I just thought it was, you know, then I used it throughout the piece and brought it back at the end. I thought it was so, so powerful.
Brahms' German Requiem will always take me back to that war, and the surprising courtesy of Iraqis whose families had been slaughtered in the Amiria shelter. I can hear Rory Peck's home-recorded cassette hissing through a weak speaker. 2 years later, I was in another war, in Bosnia, when I heard a BBC broadcast that Rory had been killed filming an attempted coup in Moscow. I played the music and remembered my friend Rory before trips to Baghdad during the long years of near isolation that Iraq faced until its next nightmare. Invasion, occupation, and more war. So far, without end.
Other times, there was one that I'd asked Jeremy, what was the music that was in your head? What was playing? And he talked about when he went back into Iraq, and his driver would always play. I was going to think what the thing is now. This shows you how senile I'm becoming. It's Panpipes, and it's
bloody hell! I remember listening to it.
But I have to think what it is. I really have to think what it is, because it's actually, you hear it and you think, my God, this is appalling. And then after a bit, really, comes one of those earworms that you have to sort of... And I thought, this is going to really outrage Radio 4 listeners, this piece of music, because it's just sort of not something to be used to. You know, maybe a favourite love song, but on panpipes. And there are a few tweets about people saying, on panpipes? But actually, at the same time, I got requests from people who wanted to try and get hold of the music. So... but for me, that was, I thought, this is so off the wall. That's what I was looking for in that case. I really wanted something that was off the wall, that you're not doing something that's predictable, that takes you into a different mood, that just introduces a whole different idea and approach. I mean, what's an American love song got to do with Iraq? Nothing, or war. But it was just very, I thought it was very effective the way it worked.
In the 1990s, driving to Baghdad felt like a journey into space to a faraway planet. At least that's the way my mind wandered as I listened to my favourite driver's only cassette. It was a collection of Lionel Richie's love songs, played on Andean panpipes. We would speed down the highway across the desert, like straight arrows flying through a flat, rocky landscape that seemed, through my half-closed eyes, at first lunar and then interplanetary as the miles and the hours passed. Baghdad felt like a remote human settlement, a city under a dome at the other end of the galaxy. We travelled in sleek, fast American monsters called GMC Suburbans. In Iraq, petrol is cheaper than water, so no one minded how much gas they guzzled. It was 900 kilometres, more than 550 miles, from Amman in Jordan to Baghdad. But it might just as well have been light years, because Saddam Hussein's Iraq was so isolated.
Yeah, so a quick bit of Googling suggests it's Say You, Say Me by Lionel Richie.
Thank heavens for the internet. Yeah, poor old Lionel originally. It's sort of murdered. The tune is murdered, but on panpipes, but it's also quite sort of catchy. And you can imagine Jeremy Bowen sitting in the back seat for 3 hours, driving down this endless road, bored out of his head, having to listen to Say You, Say Me on panpipes. It was fantastic. I thought it just really set the mood.
So let's talk about the technicality of putting this together. You know, back in the day, you'd have had studio managers and all sorts of people running around after you. Did you make this on your own? And if you did, on what kind of system?
Okay, so it's a process. I have always worked on Sadie, and I tend to do a lot of the automation. Well, I do all the automation and so on, so on, the fades and fade outs and sort of mixing it. But I always pass it through a studio manager, in this case, Neil Churchill. They did a great job, because I think it's important that someone else listens out for the sound and the pauses and so on. And we would sit and listen through to it together and decide, you know, had we got the pause right? What about the level? And also with Neil, I would test him on the music, because occasionally I thought I wasn't sure about the music, and it was just, he was a good sounding board. And I think that's a really useful thing for a studio manager. But also I want to make sure that the levels are absolutely right. And I kind of feel that he's got more of a training than I have about that. So it's a sort of final polish, really.
25 programmes. I know you didn't personally make all of them, but how long did it take from inception to the broadcast of the final show?
Well, thereby hangs a tale, because this whole series was mooted well over a year ago. And Jeremy, despite my emails, didn't really get down to writing them until not very long ago, shall we say. And we were doing them at the rate of maybe, it started off as one a week. And then as that clearly wasn't enough, it started to get to one and a half, two. And then by the end, poor old Cara, his producer, was dealing with virtually one a day in order to get the last five out. So, I mean, that's showbiz.
It's a good job you had a break for the election, really, as it turned out.
Not entirely, unneeded, yeah. It's great.
OK, so you, Mark, you're celebrating this enormous achievement and all these plaudits from the BBC by leaving.
Seemed the least I could do. Yes. Right?
Yeah. Why?
Well, I've been doing these big series. It's very intense, and my blood pressure's been going up. And I thought, well, I can stop. My wife's been pressuring me because I would, you know how it is when you make programmes. You're kind of totally preoccupied with them. You're thinking about them. It's a bit like a vicar. It's not just a job. It's a whole kind of, you're doing it all the time. It's in your head. You go to sleep. You wake up. You think about the music. You get, on the train, and it takes its toll. And it's just nice to stop for a bit. I don't know. I may carry on and do occasional programmes. I certainly like to. But in the meantime, I've just been painting my front door and, pinning up the roses, that sort of thing.
Full disclosure, as people listening to this will know, I'm an independent producer, so I spend most of my life pitching to the BBC. And I think we look at people like you and we think, well, they're very lucky because they have no pressure because they don't have to do any of this pitching. And when I said that to you the other day, you said you must be joking. You said you also, as in-house producers, have to do a lot of pitching.
Yeah, I think as in-house producers, we are very lucky. But I think that it's important that the BBC does have in-house producers, because there's a kind of ethos amongst people. You can exchange ideas. There's a spirit of the BBC, which I think is important to keep. I'm not saying that independent producers can't contribute anything. But also, we have to sell programmes now. We have to put ideas forward and get them commissioned. We don't just get them some like manna from heaven. You may be working on things like The Inquiry or some of these longer series, and we don't have to get, obviously we don't need a commission for that because the series has been commissioned and it's ongoing, and that's a sort of staple diet for us. But for those one-offs and those big series, we have to sell it like you do. And I think that's important that we have to sell it. You don't want to just give us any old tosh. We have to work for it. We have to believe in the product. And you can't sell something unless you really believe in it.
So I'm just feeling as though you had some of the frustrations inside that we do outside of thinking, for goodness sake, I've been doing this for years. Don't they trust my judgment?
Yes, that's true. But ultimately, it does come down to, the commissioning editor. It's their right to say, I don't want that. But certainly, I think I mentioned a series that an idea that had come out of the series I did in India that I really, really wanted to do. I could hear it. I could hear the music. I could hear the whole adventure and the readings and everything. And I put it to one of the commissioners at Radio 3, because I was thinking you could even have concerts for this thing. I was simply rethinking big. And the response I got was so lukewarm that I thought, okay, maybe I should just pack it in. And that wasn't the reason I left, but I just felt so disheartened. But that's what we all face as producers, and putting we've just got to get used to it. It's the real world, isn't it?
Sadly so. Mark Savage, thank you very much for talking to the Radio Today programme. Congratulations on a fantastic piece of work, and we wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much.
Let's go and find out what's happening this week in radio. Here's Stu Clarkson.
Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Thank you, Trevor. This week, Christmas is coming early for anoraks and jingle fans this year. The BBC's revealed what it's going to do to mark the 50th birthdays of Radio 1 and Radio 2 in the autumn. A digital pop-up station, Radio 1 Vintage, will be on for 50 hours over the weekend of the 30th of September. Tony Blackburn's going to recreate Radio 1's opening show on the pop-up, as well as on Radio 2's Sounds of the 60s. Later in the morning, he'll be simulcasting on Radios 1 and 2 with Nick Grimshaw. Our former Radio 1 DJs, including Noel Edmonds, Mike Reed, Chris Moyles, Janice Long, Simon Bates, Gary Davis and many more, are among those returning to introduce archive shows and special documentaries, which will go out on Radio 1 Vintage. Celador Radio has announced plans to end separate programmes from its Ipswich studios across the former Anglian Radio Group stations. All the shows instead will be networked across the five licences from Norwich, meaning a number of people are at risk of redundancy. Celador says it'll keep the various local brand names. Meanwhile, The Breeze is coming to Reading. Celador has told listeners to Jack FM Berkshire that its Breeze brand is going to launch on 107 in August. The group will be able to share all programmes on the service with its stations in Basingstoke and Dover and Newbury. Also this week, Celador's appointed former Orion chairman and CEO Phil Riley as a non-executive director. Radio X has confirmed it's put in an application to Ofcom to take over the Torbay licence that's currently broadcasting The Breeze. The Exeter Bay station is challenging the present licensee, Celador, when its current term is up. The station was previously called Palm 105.5. There's a refresh to the weekend schedule at Virgin Radio after just over a year on air. Talk Radio weeknight presenter Ian Lee going to do Sunday mornings 10 till 1 on Virgin, while Eddie Temple Morris joins to do Saturday and Sunday afternoons. BBC Radio Berkshire is looking for a new home after the corporation put Grade 2 listed Caversham Park up for sale. It shares the site with BBC Monitoring, which has reduced its staffing levels over recent years. Changes at Free Radio Breakfast in Herefordshire and Worcestershire. Hirsty and Helen are leaving. Tom Newitt moves from Free Radio Coventry's Home Run to take over. Elsewhere in Bower, Brian Moore, one of the 10 presenters losing their morning show to networking on the Big City 1 stations, has a new show. He's taking over the networked evening slot on City 2. Brian's been at Metro since 1996 and before that worked at Rock FM and Radio City in the North West. Peter Young, also known as PY, has stepped down from regular broadcasting on Jazz FM after 27 years because of ill health. The station says it hopes to have him back on for some one-off specials when his health allows it. And congratulations to Tim Blackmore, awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Radio Independence Group this week. RIG had its AGM and a party to celebrate 25 years of independent production. And don't forget, there's more news as it happens every single day at radiotoday.co.uk.
Thank you, Stu. David Lloyd after this.
Visual radio smarter and cheaper. Virtual director from Broadcast Bionics combines your social media, messaging, photos, audio and videos with intelligent camera control and automated graphics. Welcome to the social studio at bionics.co.uk.
Radio Moments, David Lloyd.
With all this talk of FM switch off, let's remember it wasn't too long ago that music stations started to shed their AM transmitters.
All Radio 1 programmes on AM 1053 and 1089 now revert to FM. Please adjust your sets, okay? Adjust your sets right now. That's all Radio 1 programmes on AM 1053 and 1089. We'll now revert permanently to FM between 97 and 99. Please adjust your sets to hear Radio 1. Radio 1 only on FM 97 to 99. 1053 and 1089 closing down in 5 minutes. So retune now if you're still on medium wave and you'll hear Stephen Tintin Duffy. You'll hear Stephen Tintin Duffy by the time you retune.
Who dare ignore Steve Wright? Radio 1 going FM only 23 years ago.
This is 1053 and 1089 medium wave, the frequencies formerly occupied by BBC Radio 1. Radio 1 is now an FM only station. Please retune your radio to FM, it may also be marked VHF or U, where you'll find us between 97 and 99.
Just over a year ago, we lost Ed Stewart, famous for his pirate radio experiences and his hosting of Junior Choice. This week, 18 years ago, he hosted his final regular Radio 2 programme.
There's Dusty Springfield. You don't have to say you love me. That was one of the last records we played on the Big L, Radio London, nearly 39 years ago. Oh, even getting on for 40, if you want to look at it that way. Anyway, I've been surprised at the depth of feeling expressed by yourselves in my leaving. Well, it's touched me and it's astounded me, but not entirely surprised me, because there's such a love of the type of music I've been playing at your request over the years, I can imagine that you're disappointed and in many cases devastated at its demise. But being an optimistic sort of person myself, well, it's been a wonderful 39 years with its ups and downs here at the Beeb. But I listened to the words of my last record just to give myself some encouragement, and thank you for being such wonderful listeners.
Hello, darling.
No one ever knew exactly who that little lad was, least of all Ed. Hello, darling. Radio 4 doesn't have a theme tune these days, which is a great pity. Its best known was perhaps the famous UK theme, but this week in 73, this tune began to herald each day's programmes, arranged just like the UK theme by Fritz Spiegel. Radio 4's skipping theme. We don't have themes anymore. We don't skip much either. That one lasted 5 years before the arrival of the UK theme. Now, in the grand scheme of things, our radio craft isn't really that old. It was this week, 90 years ago, that Christopher Stone presented his first record programme, becoming, it said, the first British disc jockey.
Christopher Stone will present a regular programme of gramophone records. Now, here is Christopher Stone with the first programme.
Good afternoon. I'd like to be able to bring this bunch of records to you. Now I'm going to put on another of Sanderson's ballads, As I Sit Here, sung by the Negro pianist and singer Leslie Hutchinson. Now you may hate it, but I hope you won't.
Christopher Stone, whose show billed simply as Gramophone Records, was aired this week in 1927, and back then playing a sequence of records rather than orchestras playing live was quite a novelty. Now, here's something rather depressing. Plaintive Sing Something Simple theme, and that programme began on the Light programme this week in 1959, and to a generation, to many generations, it meant the end of the weekend and back to school and all those horrible things. Songs simply sung for song lovers, featuring Cliff Adams and the Cliff Adams Singers with Jack Emblow on accordion. The programme ran for 42 years on the Light programme later on Radio 2. In fact, it was said to be the longest running continuous music programme in the world. 1975 now, and commercial radio arrives in my hometown.
Radio Trent broadcasts from Nottingham on 301 metres, 998 kilohertz medium wave, and on 96.2 megahertz VHF stereo. It's Thursday, the 3rd of July.
6 o'clock, good morning. The government has suffered two defeats in the Commons on amendments to its controversial industry bill.
Government suffering defeats in the Commons. Whatever next. Trent's first programme director was Bob Snyder, who'd been a pirate on board Radio 270.
I don't believe in national radio. I think all radio should be local. I mean, that's what I believe. It won't ever happen. Yes, of course, local radio should be handled differently from national radio. In local radio, there is an opportunity for intimacy and for immediacy, which just doesn't exist in national radio. Wherever you live in England, national radio is going to be remote, even if you live across the road from Broadcasting House in London, where National Radio comes from. It's going to be remote because it doesn't cater for you or your area specifically.
Bob Snyder, and I love the fact you can hear the old phones ringing on that 1975 interview, and the bangs from the builders as well as the premises on Castlegate are knocked into shape. This week in 1968, BBC Radio Durham launched. It was part of BBC's plan for 9 local radio experiments. It lasted just 4 years.
Well, this afternoon, the Minister of Posts and Telecommunications, Sir John Eden, has been answering a question in the House of Commons about the future of BBC Radio Durham. And following that answer, the BBC has now issued the following statement. It says that BBC local radio in the north of England is moving into a new area. A new station is to be opened in Carlisle. It's going to start transmissions during 1973 on both VHF and medium wave. To help finance the new Carlisle station, the BBC is going to close down Radio Durham, and transmissions here will end on August the 25th, 1972. This was one of the first of the BBC local stations and has won for itself an interested audience, but since the opening of Radio Newcastle and Radio Teesside, the whole of this area has now been duplicated by one or other of these stations.
Radio Durham, which launched 49 years ago. So with Radio Luxembourg moving from long wave to 208 metres 66 years ago.
This is Radio Luxembourg on our new frequency, 208 metres on the medium wave band.
Channel 4 announcing it was to launch a serious radio rival to the Today programme 10 years ago. AFN beginning broadcasting from London 74 years ago using BBC facilities.
Stay tuned for news next on AFN.
And Radio Caroline and Radio Atlanta becoming the first radio merger and branded approach 53 years ago.
I'm calling now Mrs. Steele, who lives at 25 Canadian Avenue, Gillingham in Kent. I hope your ear is glued to your wireless set, Mrs. Steele, because I've got special greetings going your way over the air from your husband, John.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
David Lloyd's
Radio Moments.
David Lloyd's Radio Moments concludes another Radio Today programme. Thanks to him and Stu Clarkson and, of course, Mark Savage. If you want to sample the delights of our man in the Middle East, all 25 shows are accessible via the BBC iPlayer Radio. This has been a TDC production. I'm Trevor Dan. See you next time.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.